Chapter 6. Carmen stood before the microphones and held his hands up, palms out, waiting for the shouted questions from the media to subside. After a moment or two, he began. Ladies and gentlemen, I asked for this press conference in order that I might respond to certain scurrilous accusations that have been aimed against me recently. Initially, I was reluctant to respond at all, as it seemed incredible to me that a member of Congress should find it necessary to respond to fantastic accusations levied against him by a malfunctioning machine. Frankly, the entire thing seems surreal. However, as certain members of the media apparently saw fit to take those accusations seriously, or at least take them seriously enough to give them a public airing, I felt myself compelled to respond. I had planned to come here today to respond to these allegations at some length. However, I have just this morning learned of some tragic news developments that I must comment on, after which I will be pleased to take your questions. Early this morning, he continued, sometime around 4 a.m., the well-known television news correspondent, Linda Tellerman, was found murdered in Battery Park. Also found murdered on the scene was her cameraman, Andrew Steinberg. Both had apparently been shot at close range with a 10mm semi-automatic pistol, similar to the one that the renegade cyborg, Steele, is equipped with. I have learned that sometime late last night, News 4 received a telephone call from the fugitive cyborg, Donovan Steele, saying that he wished to turn himself in and that he would do so only to Linda Tellerman, apparently because she had proven sympathetic to his case, and as a result, he trusted her. Or so he claimed to the News 4 staff. Miss Tellerman, together with her cameraman, went to the designated location, deep in no man's land, at the appointed time to meet with Steele and was subsequently murdered. Shortly after that, Steele was spotted in no man's land, and there was a firefight in which three citizens, as well as two police officers, were killed. Also killed was a young woman named Raven Scarpetti, a well-known associate of Steele's and his accomplice in that firefight. Miss Tellerman had previously worked for Eyewitness News. Recently, after her departure to Channel 4, she was the first to air the accusations against me, and I feel compelled to make some personal observations in response. I had always found Miss Tellerman to be an extremely capable reporter, a first-class television journalist, responsible and highly dedicated. I have never had any cause to question her professional abilities or her integrity, and I have never had any case to find fault with her on a personal level. Though we were never friends, we knew each other in a professional capacity, much as I know many of you, and I am deeply saddened by her death and that of her dedicated young cameraman, Andy Steinberg. Given the tragedy of her untimely death, I find myself in the awkward position of having to respond to certain allegations that she aired without, unfortunately, having her present to speak for herself or to take issue with me. Carmen paused, looking extremely troubled, took a deep breath, and let it out in a heavy sigh, then continued. Nevertheless, that is the unenviable position I find myself in, and I have little choice but to proceed. To begin with, I do not feel the necessity of defending my record as a civil servant. I feel that my record speaks for itself. As to the allegations that I have somehow framed the cyborg known as Donovan Steele and built a case against him purely out of political motives, again, I can only point to the evidence and allow it to speak for itself. I freely admit that I have always been against the misuse of technology, which in this case has resulted in a tragically brain-dead police officer being resurrected as a cyborg, a man rebuilt as a machine. On a personal level, I found it abhorrent, immoral, and even blasphemous against all the laws of God and man. On a more objective level, I found it scientifically irresponsible, with truly frightening implications for society. We have already had a graphic demonstration of what can happen when the CIA's second cyborg, the first prototype of the military series known as Stalker, malfunctioned and went insane, going on a horrifying, murderous rampage through the city and causing countless deaths before finally being destroyed. Steel was instrumental in stopping the insane cyborg known as Starker, and now, tragically and ironically, he has apparently fallen victim to the same malfunctions. I have seen the Fire Lord Strike Force Lieutenant Donovan Steel. He was a valiant and decorated police officer who had proven his devotion countless times in heroic actions on behalf of the people of the city. A family man, a religious man, a good husband, a loving father, and a dedicated public servant who gave his life in the line of duty. That he should have been resurrected without his prior consent as some kind of macabre, technological simulacrum of a man, a computerized shadow of his former self, was, in my view, an unforgivable crime against a brave and selfless man who had spent his entire life in dedicated service to the people of this city. That he should have been brought back from the dead as some kind of high-tech Frankenstein's monster is a human tragedy of indescribable proportions. And one can only guess at the inner torment that he must have suffered and is still suffering. I do not deny that the cyborg known as Donovan Steel has performed valuable service in the past. However, the past cannot speak for the present. When we construct a machine, such as an airplane, for example, that performs its function well up to a certain point, but past that point develops a malfunction as a result of flaws in its design, a malfunction that results in tragic loss of life, we do not excuse that malfunction by saying that it had performed well before the malfunction had occurred. If there is a flaw in the design, we take that machine out of service until that flaw can be corrected. And if there is a flaw in the concept of the machine itself, we scrap it before others can be killed as a result of its failure to function properly. The brave police officer who was Lieutenant Donovan Steel no longer exists. And thinking of the cybernetic organism that now bears his name in terms of who it used to be is a fundamental failure to recognize it for what it is. A machine with inherent flaws in design. A machine that should have never been constructed in the first place. No man deserves to suffer such a fate, Carmen went on, building to an impassioned climax. It is monstrous and unthinkable that a dedicated police officer should have been transformed by an immoral and untried technology into a murderous machine is an outrage against every human principle that we hold dear. The police officers and the federal marshals who died at the hands of this machine made the tragic mistake of thinking of it in those human terms which no longer apply. And now Linda Telemann has paid the highest price for making that same fundamental error. For years, I have felt that the Central Intelligence Agency had outgrown its usefulness and that we no longer had any need for a secret bureaucratic organization that answered to no one except itself. Its mishandling of Project Download, which has culminated in the creation of deadly cyborgs that cannot be controlled, and subsequent attempts to cover up those failures has resulted in Congress passing legislation to disband the agency and take control of Project Download, so that such misuse of technology and such cavalier lack of accountability, to say nothing of the flagrant disregard for the safety of our citizens, cannot occur again. It now remains to us to deal with the consequences of what the agency has done. The cyborg, known as Steel, must be found and destroyed before it can snuff out more innocent lives. For whatever is left of the man who was once Lieutenant Donovan Steel, it is the very least that we can do to put an end to his suffering. He paused with a tight-lipped grimace, looked down as if to collect himself, then gazed out at the reporters. That concludes my statement, ladies and gentlemen. I will now be happy to take your questions.
Senator, concerning Steele's claim that he was framed for the murder of those four Strike Force officers, we've received reports this morning that Chief Hardesty has run a voice print analysis on the dispatch tapes relating to that incident. We're told that the analysis confirmed that the reports for both units concerned were the voice of the same man, and that the voice prints do not match those of any of the police officers who were killed. Do you have any reaction to that? Carmen frowned.
I am not aware of any such analysis conducted by Chief Hardesty, Don. That would be, of course, part of the ongoing police investigation, and as such, concerns the police department and not Congress.
But do you have any personal reaction to it? The reporter named Don persisted.
As I have just said, Don, I'm not aware of that, and since I'm not familiar with the details, I don't feel that I can comment on it. If it's true, then it would certainly pose some interesting questions. But before I were to comment any further, I would want to have some confirmation and a briefing concerning the results of this test that you've referred to. This is the first I heard of it, and frankly, I don't want to jump to any conclusions. I will, however, be sure to speak with the police commissioner about it and get fuller details.
If I may follow up, Senator, said another reporter. If in fact those tapes prove that none of those slain officers could have called in those reports, wouldn't it seem to lend some substance to Steele's claim that he was framed for those murders?
I wouldn't know about that, Sam, and I wouldn't want to speculate. This could be a somewhat sensitive issue. As you know, Chief Hardesty was a close personal friend of Donovan Steele's, and they were once partners. There has also been a considerable amount of misplaced loyalty for Steele based on his former life as a police officer among the personnel of Strike Force, as evidenced by the so-called Black Flu that struck so many members of the squad. Again, I wish to underline that this is a police matter, and it is up to the police department to confirm any such evidence. I have thus far heard of no such confirmation, but I can promise you that I'll look into it. In any case, the tragic deaths of those four officers are not the only ones that Steele is charged with. There are the deaths of those five federal eight marshals, in addition to the crew of that helicopter that Steele confessed to shooting down. And now these killings that took place early this morning. And there were witnesses. Given the overwhelming amount of evidence against Steele, any speculation to his being framed by some political conspiracy would seem not only laughable, but highly irresponsible.
Senator, what is your connection with Victor Borodini?
I resent that question, madam, and its underlying implications. I have no connection whatsoever with Victor Borodini. I do not know the man, and I have never met him personally.
But, Senator, if I may follow up, isn't it true that you have an interest in the Coastal Transport Company, which is a front organization for one of the Borodini family's operations?
I have financial interests in a number of legitimate concerns, which my business advisors manage for me. My duties in Congress leave me no time to personally oversee all my financial affairs. I have no personal knowledge of anything known as the Coastal Transport Company. However, rest assured, if my business advisors have seen fit to invest on my behalf in any questionable concerns, I will see to it that there is a full and impartial congressional investigation of such matters. I do not know where you got your information, nor do I know if it is valid, but I can promise a full disclosure if there is any hint of impropriety on the part of any of my financial advisors.
Senator, what about your secret accounts?
I beg your pardon?
Your secret account, Senator. We've received information that your net worth is far in excess of what you have reported. And according to this information, your annual income is at least four times what you have disclosed on your taxes. How do you respond to...
I have no idea what information you are alluding to.
We've been given certain documents detailing your financial interests, your bank accounts, numerous safe deposit boxes, blind holding companies, and investments, activity in your...
I have no idea where you got these purported documents, and I frankly resent these unfounded accusations. If you have information allegedly pertaining to my personal finances, then I demand to know how you came by such confidential information and who supplied you with it.
With all due respect, Senator, a reporter's sources are confidential.
So are tax records and bank statements. Carmen replied tensely. If you have any information that alleges any impropriety on my part, then it is your responsibility to produce that information so that a full investigation can be made to determine its authenticity, or lack thereof. Frankly, I personally find it highly suspect that such alleged information happens to surface at the same time that Steele makes public allegations of corruption against me and word concerning unverified so-called tests of police dispatch tapes which purport to support Steele's claims is leaked to the media. It would seem to me that there is certainly evidence of irregular conduct here, but not on my part. And I will not comment on that further, pending a full investigation into these matters by the police commissioner's office. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That will be all.
Senator!
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 Carmen turned and left the podium, going through the door behind him so that he could not be hemmed in by the press of reporters. With his back to them, the reporters couldn't see it, but he was white-faced. How the hell had they found out about his involvement with Coastal Transport? How could they possibly have his secret accounts? Where could they have possibly gotten access to? And then it hit him. Of course. The Matrix. It was the only plausible explanation. Somehow, the Matrix had accessed protected data files and assembled a complete profile on his financial assets, secret and otherwise. There was a lot it couldn't have discovered, but obviously it had raided confidential data banks and found out that he had a lot more money coming in than he could possibly account for. He damned himself for a fool. He should have anticipated that, but he had underestimated the capabilities of the Matrix. Stupid. Stupid. Still, the damage was not irreparable. A computer program could not give evidence against him, and anything it had on him had been illegally obtained. His lawyers could easily have it disallowed as evidence. It would probably prompt an investigation, but there was a limit to how much they could learn, and by the time they got around to it, he could execute account transfers, close out his assets, and liquidate them, cover his tracks so completely that there would be nothing to discover. But he would also have to move quickly. The organization would not like it if they found out that he had become a liability. And then it occurred to him that the Matrix had to be tapping his phone lines as well. He had always been extremely careful about what he said on the phone, just in case. He had never said anything on the phone in any way that could be incriminating, but if the Matrix was tapped into his line somehow, it would know about the organization. And that meant that Steele would know as well. He wouldn't know who they were, though. No names had ever been used. If the calls had been traced, Carmen knew they would have led only to a public phone. A different one every time. The organization was extremely careful. But Steele would know that there was someone, some group, that was behind him. And that was dangerous enough. He would have to put pressure on Jennifer. She had to find a way for the Matrix to be destroyed before it destroyed him. Carmen reached his office and went past his secretary, saying, "No calls! I'm not in!" He went over to the bar and poured himself a glass of mineral water. He had to think. He started pacing back and forth across his office. Hardesty had to be in on this. That much was obvious. A voice print analysis of the dispatcher's tapes. Christ! That had never occurred to him. He had to get those tapes. He could call the commissioner. But Hardesty could have made copies. Would those tapes be admissible in court? Yes, of course they would. But wait, it didn't really matter. The only thing those tapes might accomplish would be to clear Steele of the murder of those four policemen. And there were still the other killings, the marshals, the helicopter crew, which Steele had actually confessed to, the idiot, and now Tellerman and her cameraman. And Steele would never come to trial, so it made no difference. But Hardesty was a threat that would have to be dealt with. All right, no problem. Lean on the commissioner. Hardesty was obviously collaborating with Steele. If that could be proved, then he was finished. But there were ways of getting rid of him without having to prove anything against him. Get him transferred or forced to take an early retirement or something. The commissioner would find a way. What else could the Matrix have discovered that could hurt him? Carmen suddenly stopped pacing. John Romano. Damn! He'd almost forgotten about him. He'd rushed to the phone and started to dial, then stopped. No, he thought, hanging up the phone. Don't be stupid. Don't give the game away. He felt a mounting paranoia. Romano was a loose end, a big one. If his calls to Romano had been traced... Think, he told himself. Don't go off half-cocked. If Romano was found, could his testimony do any harm? But Romano wouldn't testify. He'd know that it would mean his life. Borodini dealt harshly with anyone who crossed him. If tapes had been made of their conversations, could anything be proved? No. The calls had always been extremely brief, always phrased very carefully. Words like,
I need to schedule a meeting with our mutual friend tomorrow night. The usual arrangements.
Nothing damaging there. A conversation like that could mean anything. If the Matrix traced his calls to Romano, that didn't necessarily mean that it could link Romano up with Victor Borodini. Romano always made his calls to Borodini on a public phone, unless he had been careless. Even so, it would not be admissible in court. It would be an illegal tap. But if the Matrix knew about it, then Steele knew about it. He could tell Hardesty, and Hardesty could get the proper warrants. Hardesty had to be cut off at the knees, and Romano had to be gotten rid of somehow. He'd become a massive liability. Or had he? Carmen was struck with sudden inspiration. He reached for his phone again, picked it up and dialed.
John! Bryce Carmen! Fine, thanks. I need to set up another meeting with our mutual friend. Right, the usual arrangements. Tonight. And John, tell him that this time it's important that we speak in person. Understood? Yes, that's right. Goodbye.
He hung up the phone and smiled. The best way to deal with a liability, he thought, was to turn it into an asset. He got up and went to the outer office to see his secretary.
Joan, get me Captain Dixon right away. But don't call. Go out and get a page to send him out to find him and bring him to me personally as soon as possible. Tell him it's extremely urgent.
John Romano hung up the phone and turned around slowly, moistening his lips nervously.
You did that very well, Mr. Romano, said Steele. Now, before you call our old friend Victor, suppose you tell me just what the usual arrangements are.
Look, if I tell you that, Borodini will kill me,
said Romano tersely.
If you don't tell me, I'll kill you.
You need me to make that call.
You'll make the call.
I ain't setting up Borodini for you. No way. I can't make that call if I'm dead. And you can probably make me talk, but if you do anything to me, he'll know. He'll be able to tell if I've been worked over when I make the call from the sound of my voice. Face it, pal. Looks like we've got a standoff here.
Not necessarily, said Steele.
He got up and started walking toward Romano. Romano swallowed hard and backed away.
Look, come on, Steele. This ain't going to get you anywhere. I told you.
His voice trailed off when he saw that Steele wasn't coming for him. Steele stopped at the desk and picked up the phone. He quickly punched out a number and said,
It's me. Stand by for interface.
Romano watched, puzzled, as Steele apparently just held the receiver to his ear and said nothing. Then, a moment later, Steele held the receiver out to him.
Come here! I want you to hear something!
Romano uncertainly stepped forward and took the receiver from his hand.
Just say hello, said Steele.
Romano stared at him, puzzled, then said,
Hello? I can't make that call if I'm dead!
His own voice came back at him over the line.
And you can probably make me talk, but if you do anything to me, he'll know. He'll be able to tell if I've been worked over when I make the call from the sound of my voice.
Romano dropped the phone, staring at it as if it were a snake that had just bitten him.
How the fuck did you do that?
I can do all sorts of fascinating things, Romano,
Steele said. He picked up the receiver and hung up the phone.
You see, I really don't need you to make that call. After all, I know the number. And I can have you saying anything I want. I don't think that Victor Borodini could tell the difference, do you?
Romano stared at him with fear.
Now, about those arrangements we were talking about.
Either way, I'm dead,
Romano said emptily.
Only if that's the way you want it,
Steele replied.
I can easily get the information out of you.
He extruded his laser and fired at the lamp on the table. Romano stared. Open-mouthed.
I could start with your left knee, said Steele. Then your right knee. Then your feet. And then, perhaps, your groin. But by then, I think, you'd tell me what I want to know. Or we could avoid all that unpleasantness, and you could simply tell me now. Then we could just hang out together till tonight, send out for some beer and pizza, watch the tube, relax, then go to the meeting together. Once I was sure that it was going down, and you had no chance to warn them, I'd give you a running start. I hear Atlanta's pretty nice this time of year. Or maybe Philly, if you don't like southern cooking.
How do I know you'll let me go?
You don't! But you know what'll happen next if you don't start cooperating!
He aimed his laser at Romano's knee.
Okay, okay, I'll talk. Just put that thing away, will ya? It gives me the fucking creeps.
The laser tube slid back inside Steele's forearm with a soft whine. Steele picked up the phone.
What do you want on your pizza?
The two stretched limos pulled into the garage and stopped just inside the entrance. One of the men inside the first car conferred briefly with the guards in the booth at the entrance. Then they continued on to the third level. When they got there, the second car came to a stop slightly ahead and onto the side of the ramp. Six men got out. They were all armed with handguns and automatic weapons. One of them held a two-way radio. Three of them stayed by the car, keeping it between them and the entrance ramp, so they could use it for a shield if need be. The other three fanned out behind the support pillars on the other side. The first car continued on until it reached the far wall. Then it turned around and parked, facing the ramp on the other side of the garage. In the back, Victor Bordini sat with his son Rick and two other men. There were another three men squeezed into the front seat. The elder Bordini nodded, and the men all got out, leaving him alone inside the car, with only the driver and Rick. Bordini took out a gold cigarette case. Rick had his lighter ready. He lit his father's cigarette, then his own.
What time is it? Asked Victor Bordini.
Rick glanced at his watch. 9:45.
We're early!
Rick simply shrugged.
These meetings with Carmen are becoming inconvenient, said Victor Bordini dryly. Not to mention risky. From now on, I think, if the senator wishes to have a conference, he can fly out to the enclave.
He's not going to like that, Rick said.
I don't give a damn what he likes or doesn't like, Bordini said. He flies out to the enclave when it suits him. Otherwise, he calls Romano, snaps his fingers, and we're supposed to come running. He's starting to act as if he's the one who's in control, and I don't like that.
He's useful, Rick said.
Perhaps, but we have others on our payroll. We don't really need Carmen.
Carmen's worth more than all the others put together, Rick said.
True, but he's getting too big for his own britches. It's time we took him down a peg or two. Lately, our business relationship has become rather one-sided.
He did help us get the enclave back.
We would have gotten it back eventually anyway, said Bordini. Carmen merely helped accelerate the process. He hasn't done very much for us lately, whereas we've done rather a great deal for him. I think it's time to remind him of that.
What happens if he won't cooperate?
Accidents can happen. The distinguished senator needs us a great deal more than we need him. Thanks to Steele and to Tommy's stupidity, we've lost a lot of ground, but we're making it up quickly. We're already rid of Higgins. Once his business is concluded and we're rid of Steele once and for all, the good senator will become superfluous. And the sooner that happens, the better. Bryce Carmen is becoming nervous, and nervous people make mistakes.
Maybe we shouldn't wait, said Rick. Maybe we should whack him now.
No, not yet, but soon. So long as we have Steele to contend with, Carmen has some value. But once that cyborg's been reduced to a pile of smoldering scrap metal, then we can take care of Carmen. I'll let you have that pleasure, Rick.
Just say the word. The radio in the front seat crackled and the driver picked it up.
They're on their way,
said the man at the front entrance. They are coming, Mr. Bordini, said the driver. Bordini nodded and stubbed out his cigarette. A moment later, two black limousines with dark tinted windows slowly came down the ramp. Steele watched from concealment across the street as the second set of cars pulled into the garage entrance. John Romano stood beside him, his hands tied behind his back, his mouth gagged. Steele turned toward him and removed the gag, then used his combat bowie to cut Romano's bonds.
All right, Romano, he said. Now listen up, because I'm only going to say this once. You've got one more thing to do, and then you're free and clear. Now we're going to walk across the street together.
Wait a minute, Steele. You said you were going to let me go as soon as the meeting started to go down. I did my part.
And I'll do mine. But I need to make sure you can't shout out a warning once I start heading over there. Now shut up and listen. I haven't got much time. We're going to walk over there together. You're going to put your arm around my shoulder and keep your head down. We're going to act like we're drunk. Soon as we get over there, when I nudge you, you're going to fall down. I'll take it from there. Once I've gotten the guards at the entrance, you're free to go. But you so much as try to warn them, and I'll cut your heart out!
He held up the bowie to underscore his point.
Oh, Jesus, man, come on! Don't make me do this! You got a choice, Romano! You play it my way, or I leave you lying here, unconscious. You never know. Maybe no one will bother you while you're out cold. But on the other hand, in this neighborhood...
All right. I'll do it your way.
Okay, come on, put your arm around my shoulder. And remember, I'll be holding this right up against your side.
He showed him the knife.
Yeah, all right,
Romano said, swallowing hard.
I got the picture.
He put his arm around Steele's shoulders, and they started to stagger and weave across the street. Steele was wearing a hat and a raincoat he had taken from Romano's closet. The coat was open, and the hat was pulled low over his face. Beneath the raincoat, he wore his black Strike Force fatigues and the special belt holding his battle mods. The belt was wide and heavy, made of thick brown leather, holding pouches and studded with several oval-shaped discs that looked like large metal conches, like those hammered out of silver and used for ornamentation on the belts of Native Americans. Only these conches were not for decorations. They were specifically designed lock rings used to hold his modular appendages. His spare hands, as Steele thought of them. One looked like a miniature Gatling gun with small revolving turrets. This appendage, which Steele thought of as his Swiss Army knife, contained a voltmeter with test cables retracted into one of the small turrets, a Geiger counter, a metal detector, an adjustable socket wrench, wire cutters, a plug-in jack, and screwdrivers. One of the turrets was also a small dart launcher fed by a built-in 20-round magazine. Steele had a choice of stun darts with an effective range of about 100 feet, or explosive ones which were electrically primed, designed to ignite 20 feet downrange for rocket propulsion out to 100 yards. Or he could eject the firing tube together with its magazine and mechanism, and either use the port for his built-in laser if the mod was used in place of his detachable left hand, or attach a silencer for the 10mm pistol built into his right forearm. His second modular appendage was a unique machine pistol of polymer ceramic construction, a scaled-down version of the 4.7 battle rifle firing caseless ammo, with built-in trigger assembly, bolt and safeties, as well as a select-fire mechanism giving him the options of semi-automatic, three-round burst, or full auto, all slave to a cybernetic brain. When in place, it looked like a bizarre matte black 2x4 attached to the stump of his wrist. It had no grips or exterior mechanisms, and its polymer ceramic construction rendered it self-cleaning, watertight, and essentially maintenance-free. It had a sealed receiver to prevent the entrance of debris, and its ejection port was sealed as well, opening only to vent gas or to clear a chambered round. Since it fired caseless ammo, there was no brass to eject. It accepted a specially designed 30-round magazine that clipped to the top of the weapon in a horizontal position, the round stacked bullet down and fed into the receiver by a cylindrical rotating bolt. Essentially, it duplicated the function of Steele's battle rifle, except that it held fewer rounds and did not have a second barrel capable of firing shotgun shells. The belt pouches held spare magazines for the machine pistol as well as for the big 44 Magnum semi-auto, an updated design of the old Israeli Desert Eagle that was in a holster strapped to his left to his right thigh. The 9mm double-action backup pistol with squeeze-cocking action carried in a holster strapped above his ankle, and an outdated weapon that no modern police officer would carry, though Steele wouldn't part with it for anything. It was an ancient Colt government model 45 semi-automatic. It's blue-finished, well-worn, yet it was as reliable as any weapon Steele had ever used, despite the fact that its design dated back to 1911. The gun had belonged to his father, and Steele was never without it. He wore it now, in a shoulder holster attached to his weapons harness that also had magazine pouches for his battle rifle and loops for shotgun rounds. The battle rifle was beneath his coat, slung barrel downward over his right shoulder, so that he could grab it quickly and swing it up into action. He was armed almost as heavily as Strike Force officers in full battle gear, lacking only the full-coverage helmet and the backpack computer with vertical rocket launchers. The gear made it impossible to button up the raincoat and made it bulge suspiciously, but Steele hoped the guards at the garage wouldn't notice until it was too late. "Sing!" said Steele, and he and Romano lurched across the street together. He prodded Romano with his knife. Romano swore softly and joined in as Steele started slurring the words to a popular country song.
So hit me once again, bartender, and I'll have one more cigarette. 'Cause now I'm too drunk to remember what I was drinking to forget.
They swayed across the street like a wheel out of tune, lurching up to the garage entrance and singing at the top of their lungs, not quite in unison.
I felt so bad when I walked in here. At least it seems that way to me. Now I can't picture what she looks like. Or am I too drunk to see?
One of the guards came out of the booth as they staggered up to the garage entrance.
Hey! You two!
I can't recall now how I got here. Did I walk or drive my truck? I can't remember where I parked yet. What the hell do you fuck?
Hey!
The guard shouted.
Where the hell do you think you're going? This is where we parked our car, buddy!
Steele said.
Get out of here! Just remember, we gotta get to the car. I said get out of here! Now! Move! Before I...
Steele gave Romano a nudge. Romano staggered forward, tripped, and fell.
You stupid goddamned!
Steele dropped the guard with a left cross to the jaw, hitting him just hard enough to knock him out, but not hard enough to kill him. Then he leaped into the booth, grabbed the second guard as he was going for his gun, smashed his head against the glass. The glass cracked and the guard collapsed to the floor of the booth. Steele picked up his radio and crushed it in his hand.
All right, Romano, he said. Get lost!
Romano needed no encouragement. He quickly got to his feet and took off running down the street. Steele removed the hat and the raincoat, dropping them to the floor of the booth. He unslung his battle rifle and put it down on the console. Then he mentally released the locking mechanism on his left hand and removed it with his right. He unstuck his left wrist into the turret attachment, felt the lock snap, then twisted it off the mounting disc on the belt and snapped his left hand on in its place. The effect was surreal. It looked like he had an amputated hand hung on his belt. He raised the turret attachment and watched as it revolved with a soft whir until the dart launcher clicked into position. He only had two magazines left, one loaded with electric stun darts and one with explosive tips. The launcher was loaded with the magazine holding the stunners. They were specifically designed ordnance, built exclusively for him. With Higgins gone and the agency shut down, he wouldn't be able to get any replacements. After these two magazines were gone, the dart launcher would be useless. And if he sustained any damage now, there would be nowhere else he could go to be repaired. Not that he really cared anymore. He picked up his battle rifle in his right hand, tucked it under his arm, and thumbed the selector to 3-round burst. He didn't know how many men were down there, but he knew one thing for sure. At least 3 of them weren't going to get out alive. End of chapter.